Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, recent polling has determined that almost half of American women say they've been sexually assaulted. Best-selling author Roxane Gay's new anthology addresses that fact. Not That Bad, Dispatches from Rape Culture, is a collection of personal essays by people, almost entirely women, who have experienced rape and harassment. The work addresses a misogynistic culture in which victims of violence are often discredited, mocked, or shamed for their assault. In this conversation, Gay shares what it was like to wade through the hundreds of submissions she received and what they say about our society. She found a theme as she gathered the stories of victims who diminish what happened to them. She said to one rape survivor in the Seattle audience,
"I encourage you to recognize that you have survived a level of trauma that would break someone, but it has not broken you. And you have to say that to yourself over and over again, because it's true."
Roxane Gay is the author of the bestsellers Bad Feminist and Hunger. She is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and an associate professor of English at Purdue University. Among her many honors, she received a 2018 Guggenheim Fellowship. Gay spoke with Seattle Times columnist Nicole Broder at the University Temple United Methodist Church on June 21st. The event was presented by University Bookstore and recorded by KUOW's Sonia Harris. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
Hey, everybody. Who's excited to be here? Thank you so much for coming out tonight. My name is Anna Eklund. I'm a bookseller at University Bookstore, and it is my incredible honor to introduce our event with Roxane Gay tonight. When I was asked to introduce our speaker tonight, I didn't quite have the words to accept. I wasn't certain I could find the words to express what her writing has meant to me and what I know it has meant to all of you. Roxane Gay's list of works and jobs is long. She's a New York Times bestselling author. She's an associate professor of English at Purdue. She's a contributing opinion writer at the New York Times, and on and on. Her published works are equally wide-ranging, from the essay collection Bad Feminist, the short story collections 80 and Difficult Women, the novel An Untamed State, the memoir Hunger, and of course, Black Panther World of Wakanda for Marvel Comics. Every work of hers that I have read has shattered me, and then has helped me put myself back together. Roxane has a way of seeing straight to the heart of the matter of you as the reader and gazing at it unblinking, challenging you to gaze at it too. She helps you to be a better person, which this world can surely use right now. Tonight, she's here discussing the new essay collection she curated called Not That Bad, Dispatches from Rape Culture. It's a book that is particularly timely in light of the Me Too and Time's Up movements, in light of the conversations and blind sightings taking place around us. In her introduction to this book, she talks about how it is a place for people to give voice to their experiences, a place for people to share how bad this all is, a place for people to identify the ways they have been marked by rape culture. I think right now we all need a space carved out to talk about how bad this all is, and Roxane Gay has helped to create one. She will be in conversation tonight with Nicole Broder, a columnist at the Seattle Times, who in an interview said that she is drawn to stories about ordinary people doing extraordinary things, that she likes to help give a voice to people who may not be able to have one otherwise. This is going to be an extraordinary conversation, so please join me in welcoming Nicole Broder and Roxane Gay.
What a beautiful introduction. Thank you so much. Don't you want to tear up a little bit or something?
That was one of the finest introductions I've ever been given.
Thank you. Very nice. Thank you. We had no idea. We were all sitting back there just talking about The Bachelorette. I had no idea that you'd... That's lovely. So obviously you're well loved. You should move here to Seattle, you know?
Yeah. No.
Place is packed.
Yeah, but no. I'll keep visiting regularly, though.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you love Los Angeles.
I love Los Angeles.
Yes, good. I wanted to ask, you mentioned difficult women. Is any of your work being turned into film, or what do you have going on?
An Untamed State is a movie. We just finished the screenplay, and we're hopefully going to move forward. It's at Fox Searchlight. And
this is Difficult Women? Or
no, An Untamed State.
Oh, okay,
my novel.
Great. Got it.
And Bad Feminist has been optioned by Amazon. And I'm writing a TV show for them.
Yeah. Who would be your bad feminist?
So none of the stories in Difficult Women have been optioned yet, but I'm sure at some point that will happen.
Yeah, I am sure too. Yeah. These are just the kind of stories that need to be widespread everywhere and, you know, put women in behind the camera and in front
of the
camera.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, good. So Hunger is debuting on the New York Times bestseller list at number 9, and Not That Bad will be at number 15, so you have two books on the New York Times bestseller list at once.
I do.
No big thing. No big thing. And I have to say, she was describing everything that you do, and you still have time to tweet and write and do, how are you a very organized person or no?
No, not at all. I am wildly disorganized and terrible with deadlines.
Okay.
I'm not proud of it, but it's just the truth. And fortunately, I'm at a place in my career where I'm tolerated, even though I'm terrible.
That's where
with
you
deadlines.
Want to get in life. It's like, yeah. You know what? I'm tolerated.
I think if I hit within a week or two of a deadline, then it's basically on time. So I just am a workaholic, and I don't sleep much, so, and I don't have kids, which helps.
Yeah, that would help a lot,
it
actually.
Does. I love kids, but I also know that it is very time-consuming to have a family and also to be a writer, so.
So is there, I mean, this is just for me because I'm a writer nerd. I love to hear how writers write and where they find their inspiration and where they find the time to do it, because sometimes it's the last thing I want to do. You know, so do you get up and write? Do you have any kind of routine, or is it just
nope.
when you feel like it?
I wish it was when I feel like it. It's triage.
Okay.
So I look at all the work I have to do and I chip away at it slowly but surely.
Right.
I prefer to write at night and after it's dark, which makes writing in the summer a pain in the ass.
Yeah, never go to Alaska.
Yeah.
Just don't. You'll never get anything done.
When I was in Sweden, it would get dark at 3 a.m, and I was just like, what the fuck? It was great. It was actually really interesting, but it was also really challenging because I like that darkness outside. So I don't have a routine. I just write whenever I can for as long as I can.
And there's also a lot to be said for being pissed off, you know, when something really...
Oh, well, yeah, when something happens in the news or in the world that I feel the need to respond to, oftentimes in the moment I will have an opinion and I'll start to put something down. But increasingly I'm taking some time to put some distance between the heat of the moment and what I have to say, because the internet is littered with really fast responses, and I understand why. When you're up and coming as a writer, you have to feed the beast and you have to work really fast, and that's fine. And oftentimes people can do really interesting work, but I find that I work better when I have a day or a week or a month to really sit with something and see how I feel and process it. And so I'm still passionate, but I try to temper that heat of the moment.
I think that's really wise. You want to let the smoke clear a little bit.
I do, and I think that we need to give ourselves more time to make sense of things. Oftentimes when something happens, editors are in my inbox like 5 minutes later, like, do you want to respond to the Beyonce album? And I'm like, it's like 40 minutes long. I'm going to have to hear the whole thing first. And I think we have to resist that impulse. Mm-hmm. I think people can and should wait sometimes, because when you respond too quickly, a lot of it can be really half-assed and short-sighted. And sometimes the story isn't even finished before people are writing about it. Mm-hmm. So I just want to take more time, and I can take more time, which is great.
So when the editors are emailing you about something, what are they looking for, do you think?
Oh, they want to be first.
But they want you.
They do want me.
Why?
Yes.
Why is that, do you think?
Because I'm very good at what I do.
Okay, I love you. All right, so let's talk about this new book, Not That Bad.
Yes.
Which is a collection of essays about rape culture. Your timing is amazing and impeccable.
I try.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about how the book came together, and something you talked about, which is, this is kind of a two-parter, but I love the basics, the logistics of how it came together, and the submissions and all that stuff, but also what it means to live in a world where rape culture exists. That's something that you touched on in the book. So I wanted to just, I think we all know where the idea came from, but can you talk about how you pulled it together?
Yeah, I sold Not That Bad after Bad Feminist came out, and I was thinking about what I wanted to do next, and I had already sold Hunger, but I thought that it would be interesting to open up a conversation and include voices other than myself, because plenty of people have things to say about rape culture. So my initial conception of the anthology was to be cultural criticism, with essays about the phrase rape culture, and what does it mean to date and have relationships in a world where this exists, and what do we do with all of these statistics that are regurgitated time and again, and it's important, but those statistics tend to obscure the realities of what it means to have endured sexual violence or sexual harassment. And so I was really looking for writing that would engage with that. And I decided to open up submissions. I ended up receiving 330. And when I started reading the submissions, I realized that my best laid plans were not going to come to fruition, because nearly every submission was testimony, was someone who had a story and they needed to share it. And that's actually why I had to reject most of those submissions, because they weren't essays. They were women,
this
terrible thing happened to me and here's what happened. Mm-hmm. There was no craft to it, but it was heartbreaking to just see how much pain there is, and how much pain there is specifically around sexual violence, and how far-reaching the repercussions are for pretty much everyone who has been assaulted or harassed. And so that's when I realized, okay, this anthology needs to be something else. And so I solicited about half of the work, and I took half of the work from the submission queue, and I'm really pleased with how it came together.
What struck me is the breadth of the types of people. You have men in there, you have transgender. You have young women, older women. I wrote a column about when Me Too first started, and it was my experience and then a commentary on just how the whole thing was unfolding and how everyone thought it would only last one news cycle, what have you. Two things. One, I heard from women in their 80s and 90s. I was struck by older women, much older women, telling me the stories. And in some cases, I was the only person they had ever told, which I'm wondering if some of your essays were maybe the first time those stories were put to paper. But the other part was, everybody talks about the trauma and the post-traumatic and how it stays with you forever, and how these experiences, I'm still remembering slights and weird shit that's happened to me. And even the weekend after Me Too came along, I was at a wedding and one of my friends, my best friend's brothers, was all had a few drinks in him and said, you know, I could have had you back in the day, and I could have had you back then, like I was something to be consumed, you know. So I'm struck by just what these stories, how you went through them, how you sorted through them, what you were trying to represent, and I also think there were these threads that went through them in that everyone was traumatized and what they did with it.
Yeah, I was just looking for interesting, well-written stories. And I was looking for people to say interesting and original things about the experience of assault or harassment. And it was important for me to do that with a diverse group of writers, and I mean that not just demographically, but also aesthetically, so that there would be a range of narrative styles and approaches throughout the essay collection. And it was just really interesting to see that when I started narrowing down what I thought I would include, there were some really common themes that were coming up again. And I thought that really contributed to the overall impact of the book, that nearly everyone diminished their own experience in some way. And thought, okay, well, what I went through sucked, but it wasn't that bad. And I'm really interested in that diminishment and why we do it and how damaging it is to do that. And I was also interested in the after effects, not just what happens in the moment, even though there was a lot of writing about that, but how it undermines confidence and how it tempers joy and
impacts intimacy.
Absolutely. And relationships, both friendly, romantic, familial. It's a cancer in many ways that infects the aspect, every aspect of one's life. And it was interesting to see just how powerful the collection was becoming as I started to put all of these essays together.
You say good stuff. Sometimes I'm going to write it down.
Oh, feel free.
So I wanted to talk about a few of them. Aubrey Hirsch, I really loved Fragments because I especially love the advice that she had for her sons or the things that she was going to teach her sons to say. Like, is this okay? And, you know, there's a whole nother side to that. And then she had a bunch of things that she, I don't know if people have read the book, but in this one essay, she describes taking a birth control pill at in a cafeteria with a friend, a male friend sitting there, and he said, why are you taking that here, out in the open, where people can see you? They're going to think that you're easy because you're taking a birth control pill. And she was, you know, she took it. But every little thing can be seen as, can be interpreted in a twisted way.
Yeah, Aubrey's essay is the first essay in the collection, and it was, to my mind, the best essay to open the collection with, because what she really showed was a lot of the seemingly smaller things that happen, the sexual harassment, the comments when you're walking down the street, the esteemed writer that visits your campus and hits on you, and how they accumulate, and how they really start to reshape how you see yourself, and how you see men, and how you see intimacy. And so I thought it was a really good essay to set the tone. And it did set the tone. And it's actually one of the most frequently mentioned essays, for many reasons, partly because a lot of the reviewers only read the first essay.
Not me. I just loved it.
But also, it's a very good essay.
Yeah. And then Charisse Tracy, another essay. When she was 13, her father sexually assaulted her. She told her mother and her father, and you know, shared it with her parents. They went to therapy, and the therapist told them to go to Magic Mountain, to go on an outing together to fix things.
Yeah, people have the most asinine advice and sort of punishments for people who commit sexual assault and rape. And to tell a young girl who has just been raped by her father that they should go to Magic Mountain as if Disney World will fix everything just shows that people don't even understand, or they understand and they don't care. and they think, oh, this is fine. I went to boarding school, and recently, for the past 2 years, we've been dealing with a lot of scandal because one of the teachers that was there during my time actually had an affair with a student, and then there was a young man who sexually assaulted a girl by grabbing her ass and cornering her and doing all sorts of things. And Reverend Thompson, who has been the school reverend for since I was there and before, and he's also an alumnus, he told the young man that he should bake the girl monkey bread and give it to her. And so he's on leave, which thankfully. Unfortunately, there's some other stuff going on there because Reverend Thompson is black and Exeter is racist, but he advised that this young man bake monkey bread as if that would make everything better because he didn't want to damage the young man's future, but he wanted the young man to put some effort into reconciling. And it's just, when you think about it, it becomes more and more offensive. And it's the same thing that Charisse talks about in her essay, that no, never does it occur to people to suggest going to the authorities and having actual consequences for these people who commit these crimes. And it's, I think that's in many ways even more horrifying than the prevalence of sexual assault. It's the way we respond to it as a culture.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I liked about the book, you know, there's this discussion about did it really happen? You know, a lot of what came out of Me Too was people felt for the first time that they were being listened to, that people actually believed these stories. And I look at Not That Bad as something you can kind of hit people over the head with. You know, a collection that's going to be kind of a brick, that these things actually happen. They're well written by intelligent women. The stories are complete, and men, and the stories are varied in the things that happen. Do you understand? It just feels like it's such a it's evidence. It's literary evidence.
It is, but you know, the thing is, evidence has been around for millennia.
Yes.
And people have ignored it. I do hope that people will read this book, and hopefully because it's collected together, it will have, and it's so many different writers, it's 29 writers, hopefully that will have an increased impact. I was at an event the other day in New York, and a young man came up to me during the signing line, and he said, I've hurt women in the past, and I just want you to know that this book has changed me and is making me go get help because I don't want to hurt women anymore. And I was really moved and also like kind of scared because he was one of the most handsome men I've ever seen in my life. He was flawless. And I was just like, wow, this young man already knows he's done damage. I mean, he couldn't be older than 25. And I just thought, wow, what happens in a world where a 25-year-old man knows he's already done damage to women? And I don't know what kind of damage, he didn't specify, but he had enough self-awareness to know he had done wrong and that this book was helping him to face that. Mm-hmm. And I hope that more men read this book, and women too, but mostly it's men that need to read it. Women know what's up, and I feel like we're good. It honestly, I do. I think it's time for men to do some homework and some soul searching. And a lot of men will say, and they often say this to me, well, you know, I would never hurt a woman, and I've never done anything like this. And I think, I'm sure you haven't, but if your partner has ever said no and you've cajoled and wheedled her into having sex by persistence, you're part of the problem. And if your friends have bragged about their sexual exploits and diminished and degraded women,
and you said nothing,
and exactly, and you were silent, you are part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And then they say, but you know, then you're trying to, you know, emasculate me. I'm like, no, be a dude. Smell and whatever. Sit with your legs spread open because of whatever. And you know, it's fine. No one's telling you to not be a man, but we are telling you to not be an asshole.
So on that note, do you think, we were talking about who should read this book. You said men and women should read this book.
Yes, but mostly men.
Yes, but it is difficult. It's a tough read. I mean, I couldn't read it all. I mean, not like I was just like sitting down with a big cup of tea going, okay.
Yeah, it's not cozy reading.
Let's read it. It was, I had to put it down. Mm-hmm. And people, some of the essays, they hang with you. I mean, it's difficult, but it's worth it. And it's, you knew this. Can you talk about, did that happen with you in curating these pieces? How did it affect you?
Well, I mean, it's never pleasant to read this many dark and painful stories of the suffering of others. So reading the submissions was interesting and eye-opening and heartbreaking, and there were definitely days when I was like, I can't go into that submission queue today because I'm having enough of a bad day. Let's not make things even worse. It was difficult, but it was not so difficult that I couldn't do it. It was just difficult, and it's supposed to be difficult. Yeah. These are difficult things. I think the day that we start to look at these kinds of stories and feel nothing, we have a real problem, because it means we've become immune to tragedy and suffering.
Right.
And I don't think that is... I think that's terrible. I think that's just a very dangerous precedent to set. So I know that this is a difficult anthology to read, and I don't know that anyone's going to curl up with it for a fun weekend of reading.
It's not a beach book. It's not a beach reading.
But I do think that you can go back and forth and skip around, and some people have been reading it front to back, and I think that's also admirable. So it just, I think it really depends on the reader and the space that they're in.
And there's comfort too, and it's this collective, you know, everyone feels some measure of what happened in these essays. And I'm assuming, I hate to assume, but I think I can, that everyone in this room has had some kind of something that, you know, you read this and you go, oh boy, I believe every single one of these people. I understand what was going on here. It's a real, there's a strange kind of comfort in it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of companionship, for lack of a better word. A lot of the sense that I'm not alone. I'm not the only one who has dealt with this. I'm not the only one who finds this painful or frustrating or inexplicable. And a lot of the response I've had since the book came out is that sense of feeling some solidarity and feeling less alone, which is wonderful to hear and also heartbreaking to hear, because there's a reason why people are connecting. And the reason oftentimes is personal experience, and you don't want that for anybody. But I'm also glad that the book can be there to provide solace and to motivate people to want to create change and to make a difference, hopefully.
So there's hope in it. I mean, there's...
Absolutely.
Do you feel like things are changing, and do you feel hopeful?
I don't feel hopeful. No, I'm not going to lie to you. But I do think things have the potential to change. I think we're in as good a position as we've ever been to try and create change, as long as we sustain the energy that has been generated thus far by Me Too and Time's Up. You know, you already hear people talking about fatigue and backlash and worrying this over, and, oh, it's gone too far. No, rape is going too far. Talking about it and talking about the repercussions and naming the criminals who commit these crimes, that's not going too far. And so we just have to sustain this moment. And the justice system needs to respond appropriately and really come up with an ethical and sustainable way of dealing with these crimes.
Well, I looked at Bill Cosby and I almost fell off my chair. I mean, I couldn't believe that he was convicted. It was the greatest...
Yeah, that was interesting. I'm glad he was convicted. He deserves to be convicted. I'm still shocked it happened, but I also think that at some point you look at the evidence and you look at the sheer number of victims and you just can't deny it. I think the sheer number of victims and the longevity of his predation was such that that jury had no choice.
Right. I remember the New York Magazine cover of all the...
Yeah, that was incredibly haunting to see all of those women, and then the empty chair.
Yeah.
For all of the women who have not come forward. And for every woman that's come forward, you have to imagine there are three who did not. And so, you know, we're looking at hundreds of women.
One guy.
Yes. And because it's a relatively small amount of the population that's committing these crimes, but they commit them with enthusiasm. And oftentimes they are serial predators.
Yeah, because there's the entitlement. They figured
Absolutely.
Out how to do it. They can get away
and they
with
get
it.
Better at it.
They get better at it. Yeah. What is different about sexual assault from other violent crimes? And why are we so uncomfortable with it?
I think we're uncomfortable with it because people treat women as second-class citizens, and so anything that happens to women is not as bad as something that happens to men. So we just intrinsically diminish sexual violence against women. I also think so many people have the blurred lines mentality that it's not really rape. It's just regret. And, you know, but mostly it's just about women and misogyny.
Yeah. And our victims are not believed.
Correct.
Obviously. But
because, you know, why would he do that? You're a woman. And people just don't want to believe women. And I also, the better part of me thinks people don't want to believe that human beings are capable of such violence, but they are.
I wonder if it's just too personal for people to wrap their heads around, too, the things that you have to...
I mean, that could be it, but I think it's just mostly misogyny. People hate women, and they hate women's experiences, and so they just don't want to believe women. And it's hard to face that, but I think that's 85% of the issue, which is very sad.
I hope that that's changing. I'm hopeful. I mean, because you look at the kind of women who are speaking out and you look at...
Well, that's actually the problem. The kind of women that are speaking out are generally wealthy and white. And so people are going to believe them because they're like, yes, of course Uma Thurman has dealt with this. And of course Aja Argento has dealt with this. But we're not seeing the stories of women who can't afford to come forward and who can't afford to jeopardize whatever professional standing they
right.
have.
And who don't have a voice.
Correct. And that is not to diminish the stories of the women that have come forward, because what's been interesting is that so many of the actors that have disappeared that I really loved, now we know what happened to them. Harvey Weinstein happened to them. So that's just painful. Annabella Sciorra. Mira Sorvino, they are incredibly talented. And it's a shame that they had to deal with this. But in addition to being concerned about that, I'm concerned about the working class women and the women of color that don't get to come forward as much. Lupita Nyong'o shared her own experiences with Harvey Weinstein, and it's never discussed, ever. And
she's not mentioned with the other victims.
No, not at all.
Right.
And
right.
Race absolutely has a part to do with that. And so, yeah, it's good to be hopeful about this, what's going on, but I think it's hope for white women and for wealthy white women. Working class women and women of color and transgender women are absolutely not being heard in this moment as much as they need to be heard. And they are also facing higher levels of predation. And they are facing more severe consequences if and when they
right.
choose to come forward. So that's
these aren't
why,
just roles. These
no.
are jobs. These are
lives.
These are lives. Yeah.
And that's why it's hard to feel hopeful, because Me Too has come, but not for all of us.
So what would you like to see? What would you like to see happen? Yeah, absolutely. What would you like to see happen? And I'm not going to say, you know, part of me feels like, oh, well, when white women open the door for, you know what I mean? Like they're...
Well, because they don't.
Exactly. it's true. But why do we have to wait for them to open the door? You know
yeah.
what I'm saying? I mean...
Well, the thing is, they don't open the door. They go through the door and shut it after them. And so that's why it's, again, it's hard to be hopeful. What I would like to see happen is to just kick the door down And then, more importantly, the media take as much interest in the stories of non-famous women as they are taking in the interest of women. And let's focus on the prurient details. So many of these articles just like want all the details, the salacious details. They want to make it this, and it just contributes to this idea that rape isn't that bad. Like, oh, tell us more. The details don't matter. What matters is that a woman was violated. And what matters is that she has been profoundly affected for many years. And I wish there was more focus on that instead of the what and the when and the why. Beyond, of course, journalistic standards. I'm fine with journalistic standards and vetting. And I know that it has to happen, even though it's frustrating that women's stories require this much due process, and yet when it comes to justice, none of that due process is anywhere to be found. Mm-hmm. So it's just the media, I think, has to play a big role. And again, the justice system has to figure out what to do. Fewer than 10% of rapists are prosecuted and go to jail, which is an appalling statistic, and that has to change. But we also have to look at what we're doing to people when we send them to prison, because in general, they just go and they learn how to become better rapists. There's no rehabilitation, and though I tend to reserve my empathy for the victims, I do still believe that we need a justice system that is focused more on rehabilitation mm-hmm. than just incarceration.
Yeah, I agree. And recovery, you know. That's something that now you have my head stirring. When the time's up, organization is raising all this money for the defense funds for rape victims, mm-hmm. so they can report these rapes.
Yes,
correct?
So they're raising money for not just rape victims, but assault, sexual harassment in the workplace. So they're providing resources for women who traditionally do not have the resources.
Okay. So that's one good thing.
Yeah, it's a very good thing. I'm very encouraged by Time's Up. I think time will tell how effective it is, but a lot of money has been raised, and some very competent people are behind it, which is always important.
Who are you most impressed with, or who do you wish would get more involved in this?
Tarana Burke, who created Me Too.
Yes.
I think that she deserves more attention than she's getting. People seem to just obligatorily reference her when they get called out, but she is the one who started Me Too. And people like, I do like her, but Rose McGowan is taking up quite a lot of the air in the room. And I just think that's fine, but let's also look at what Tarana Burke is doing. And there are other women who are doing things, and I'm terrible at just coming up with names off
the
top of my head.
But she was at the Oscars, though, wasn't she on the
yes,
stage?
Yes, she was at the Oscars, but which is nice.
Okay.
But she's doing far more important work than going to the Oscars. She is actively touring the country and talking about these issues, and she's doing a lot of important work behind the scenes in terms of bringing visibility to women of color who have dealt with sexual violence. And I wish people would talk about that as much as they would talk about the more celebrity-ish aspects, because she's actually doing the work.
Yeah.
Yes.
And she's, yeah. Not just wearing t-shirts. I want to make time for questions. So I think we're pretty ready. You ready? You up for some?
I am up for some questions.
Okay. All right.
I was just wondering if you could give a list of books that you would recommend reading besides your own, because I love all the ones that I've read of yours so far. And would love to hear what else you like to read.
I read everything. I would recommend Sing Unburied Sing by Jessamine Ward.
Yes, I loved it.
Which I thought was beautiful. I actually just finished a book called Bad Blood by John Carreyrou, which is about the Theranos scam. And it's really good and really interesting and fascinating to see how this girl dropped out of Stanford after 2 years with no real scientific background and got $900 million in funding from Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Rupert Murdoch, a bunch of like fancy hedge funds, and did it on a lie. On a product that does not exist and that the version that did exist doesn't work. It's really good. I always recommend N.W. by Zadie Smith because it's my favorite novel other than The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton, which is my also favorite. So yeah, those are some things that I recommend.
But not To Kill a Mockingbird.
No.
She just wrote a review of a book about the To Kill a Mockingbird, and she was not impressed.
No, I wasn't, because, no. It's the cover review of the New York Times book review Sunday, so you can check it out.
Hi, Roxanne. My name is Mandy, and
hi.
I was curious, did you ever get in touch with the man who raped you in the woods?
No, absolutely not.
Hi, Roxanne. Over here. So you have a very big presence on social media, and I'm wondering how that impacts your energy, your empathy, your writing, because you're really willing to be out there and be vulnerable, and as, like if you say in your Twitter profile, I clap back. So if someone comes after you, you're back out there. And does that take a toll? And do you feel like that's part of your being a literary citizen or a spokesperson?
No, I don't. I'm just on Twitter for fun. Honestly, people overestimate how much time Twitter takes for me. I used to live in the middle of nowhere, actually still sort of do, and so I went on Twitter in 2007, and it was just a way to talk to other writers and meet other writers while living in a town of 4,000 in northern Michigan. So that's how it started, and it just snowballed. And now, of course, now that I'm more visible and I have a bigger platform, for lack of a better word, I get all sorts of bullshit and harassment because whenever a black woman dares to have an opinion, there are about a million white men who are ready to tell her that she should die. So does it take a toll? The harassment absolutely takes a toll. It absolutely does. And it's soul destroying because it's not just on social media. These people send me mail at my job because I teach at a state university, so my address at work is publicly available. They send me email at my job. They email my boss. They send death threats. They email me. They Instagram message me. They Facebook message me. They Tumblr message me. There's no escaping it. And so you can filter it out, certainly, but it's still lots of stuff still gets through the filters. And so it's just soul-destroying. But I think that's humanity.
And here you are. You're still here.
Well,
kicking ass.
Yes.
I mean, you know, let them, you know, talk to Lindy. She went after one of her trolls, and it was the greatest thing in the world. It was it was epic. So, anyway, are you a drinking person? Do you drink?
I drink. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Hi. So as someone who's visibly Muslim and black, I think at this point in my life, I'm only 21. But my question is, for you specifically, I think it's really hard at times to maybe find hope, specifically a black woman and an American, and at times where, you know, your identity is always questioned and you always have to constantly fight for your existence. I guess my question is, do you have hope for the future? I mean, hope is such a hard question to wrestle around, like to grasp and wrestle with, specifically as you're constantly being marginalized in this world, and it's not fair to ask a black person, to say the least. But I really think it's quite the, it's it's very early for me to be a skeptic at 21. I have a huge line of or life ahead of me of disappointment. So my question is, have hope, I guess, even, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I ask myself that question every day. It's really hard right now. It's really hard. Like, I knew that when Trump was elected, I was like, wow, this is gonna be really bad. And that was such an of how bad it has been. Like that, I wish it was just bad, but it's horrific. And so it's really hard, but I also think that we have to continue to have hope, or what are we doing? Why are we waking up each day? Why are we fighting each day? So I just think it's one of those things where you have to make the subversive choice to have joy and to have hope. Otherwise, they win. And that's what they want. They want us to ask ourselves, how do we have hope? Because they want to break us down so that we stop protesting when they do some new insane thing. And it's not working, but they're getting close because, I mean, it's getting kind of exhausting. And it's a privilege to say that. Oh, I'm tired of the news. Yeah, imagine if you were watching your child be pulled away from you and put into an internment camp. That's, I'm sure, infinitely more exhausting. And so I think we just have to, I think hope is a form of resistance at this point. And so I see it as a responsibility. But there are days when I struggle. Ready? Yeah. Also, you're 21, like, and you're adorable. So just remember, like, you have so much time left to do a really interesting and important work and to have adventures. So focus on that too.
Hi there. I wanted to ask how you navigate holding survivors accountable. As a rape survivor myself, I understand the importance of giving space for survivors to process their trauma, be heard, feel supported. At the same time, especially now with Me Too, we have folks coming out on social media and, you know, kind of outlaying the things that have happened to them, sometimes in problematic ways, especially for white, middle class, upper class women. And I'm just interested to hear how you try and acknowledge some of the problematic things that folks say while also respecting the fact that, you know, they had to endure something really traumatic and all of the complexities of that.
When you say problematic, what do you mean? Like, what is a problematic thing a rape survivor would say?
So survivors both of sexual or any type of sexual violence, like one common one that I saw was folks saying hashtag me too, but I was only sexually harassed.
Oh, yeah, I think you have to, you have to forgive them. Like, there's nothing, I mean, that's problematic, but that's misogyny at work. You have to have empathy for a woman who says that. It's not their fault because they're told, we're told every single day to walk it off, to suck it up. So when a woman says, I was only sexually harassed, she is a victim of this culture that tells her, you were just sexually harassed, what are you crying about? And so they're not actually the problem at all. They are just in a system. You know, we do have to hold each other accountable. You know, being sexually assaulted isn't a free pass to say whatever bullshit you want to say and be horrible. Like, it's not a protected class. So if you are a sexual assault survivor, you can also be an asshole. And you can call someone out for being an asshole. Like, they're not, like, shielded by their past. And so when someone does something that's actually problematic, call them out. But when someone says something like, I was just harassed, or I was just date raped, or whatever, just feel some tenderness to them and say, why are you diminishing your own pain? And to what end? That's what I try to do. Because when you ask that question, a lot of times they'll say, yeah, actually, that's a good question. Why am I doing that?
Hence the title of your book.
Not that bad.
Not that
Check
bad.
Check it out.
Yeah. Buy the book. It's in the back.
Side note, I did check it out. It's an amazing book. Everyone should read it. Okay, so I love your book, and I'm very curious, just as a reader and also as somebody who researches sexual assault disclosure, social reactions to sexual assault disclosure, and works with a lot of sexual assault survivors, what do you think is the role of sexual assault narratives and coming forward and laying this all bare for the public to see by survivors? What is the role of that work in ending sexual violence, rape culture, changing this terrible thing we're all living in?
I don't know, because you know, a lot of people recently, in the past year and a half, have said, men, I should say, have said, I had no idea it was this bad. And I actually chewed this guy out on Twitter. I really fucking laid into him, like, what the fuck? Where have you been? He was a reporter for the New York Times, so like, you don't even read your own paper? What is your problem? You know, the reality is that women have been sharing their narratives of sexual violence for as long as sexual violence has existed. And those narratives have done nothing to move the needle. And so I don't know what the role is. I do think that all too often women are expected to cannibalize themselves. And they're expected to testify and share their pain. And they're validated for doing that sharing. And so I think it's a very personal choice. I think for a lot of women, there is closure and catharsis in coming forward and saying, this happened to me. Because historically, there has been so much silence around sexual violence. At the same time, I hate that that seems to be the price of admission for a woman to be understood and for her suffering to be validated. Like, you have to tell all of the details. I remember when Bad Feminist came out, a woman reviewed the book, and she said that when I didn't detail my rape in my essay, What We Hunger For, she got so angry, she threw the book across the room. And I was just like, bitch, what? Like, there was this expectation that I wasn't doing my job as a writer because I didn't want to share the gory details of being gang raped at 12 years old by a bunch of men in a fucking hunting cabin. Like, it's not a great story. And I think that it's my right to keep those details to myself because my parents are alive and my partner is alive. And are these things that you want in their head? I don't want them in my head. And so this expectation, even in intellectual circles, exists when people should know better. And so anytime a woman doesn't want to share her story and resists that sort of cultural demand that she bear herself, I applaud it. I think it's a personal choice, and we should encourage women to make whatever choice they feel is best.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Roxane Gay is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and an associate professor of English at Purdue University. She edited the new essay anthology, Not That Bad, Dispatches from Rape Culture. Gay spoke with Seattle Times columnist Nicole Broder at the University Temple United Methodist Church on June 21st. The event was presented by University Bookstore. Thanks to KUOW's Sonia Harris for our recording. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. While you're there, check out other great Seattle area talks by subscribing to our podcast. Tune in again soon.